chapter of creation's journey to an untimely end. In the other future, Corton says, we find our rightful place as responsible, loving members of the Earth community in an ecological civilization, helping to guide creation's journey into a future of harmony and new possibilities. The choice could not be more profound. It is, in a real sense, a test of what being human truly is. Our guest today is the visionary intellectual David Corton. For several decades, he was an insider in the development establishment. He worked for the Ford Foundation and USAID and taught at Harvard's Graduate School of Business. Having severed his ties to the past, today he is a leading voice for economic and social justice. He's the author of many books, including When Corporations Rule the World and Agenda for a New Economy. He spoke in late August in Bainbridge Island, Washington. And now, David Corton.
We live in a time of profound challenge and opportunity. The signs of crisis are all around us. A mounting perfect storm of climate disruption.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I am so disgusted with this administration. I think that Pam Bondi and Cass Patel both need to resign. And I would love to see number 47 get impeached over this.
The DOJ releases the largest batch of files yet on the federal investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. What are the most significant revelations? We'll hear from Epstein survivors and speak with investigative journalist Vicki Ward, host of the podcast Chasing Ghislaine, the untold story of the woman in Epstein's shadow. Then we speak to longtime immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueta Ramirez, just released from a Colorado ICE jail. A judge ruled her detention was unconstitutional.
This moment is when mixed emotions and my person and my family, 9 months, 7 days, stress, long time in detention.
And an update on growing calls to release Palestinian activist Lakal Kardia, who joined Gaza Solidarity protests at Columbia University and has been detained in an ICE jail in Texas for nearly 10 months after she went to her ICE check-in in New Jersey. We'll speak with Palestinian journalist Leila Haddad.
Hi, it's Leila Haddad, and I'm here at the Prairie Land Detention Center in El Dorado, Texas. I'm here with Travis Fife, who's one of Lakal Kardia's lawyers, and we just got finished with a meeting with her.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Venezuela's accused the United States of the greatest extortion in history as the Trump administration ramps up economic and military pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. During an emergency UN Security Council meeting Tuesday requested by Venezuela, Russia and China strongly condemned the Trump administration's escalating attacks. Is ushering in a regime change to appropriate Venezuela's resources. Venezuela holds the world's largest oil reserves. Meanwhile, Venezuela's National Assembly has passed a law enacting harsh penalties for piracy in response to the U.S. seizure of Venezuelan oil tankers. This is Venezuelan Assembly member Jorge Rodriguez.
En consideración In consideration, honorable deputies, those in favor of approving the second discussion of the bill for the protection of freedom of navigation and trade against piracy, blockade, and other illicit international acts, please indicate with you. The law is approved unanimously.
Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz is walking back his comments that Israel plans to resettle the Gaza Strip after suggesting the Israeli military would never leave the besieged enclave. Speaking at a settlement in the occupied West Bank, Katz mentioned Israel could establish military outposts in northern Gaza.
We are deep in Gaza, and we will never leave Gaza. We are there to defend, to prevent what happened. We are standing. As we said, we trust the Rock of Israel and the IDF in defending Israel in a fierce battle between jihadist enemies of this kind and Israeli enemies of this kind.
Since the U.S. brokered ceasefire went into effect in October, Israel's constructed at least 13 new military outposts inside Gaza, primarily located along the Yellow Line in eastern Khan Yunis, according to satellite imagery reported by Dropsite News. This comes as a former close aide to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Netanyahu asked him after Hamas's October 7th attack to come up with a plan to avoid blame for Israel's security failure. Netanyahu's former spokesperson, Eli Feldstein, made the accusation in an interview as he faces trial for allegedly leaking classified information to the press. In the interview, Feldstein said he was instructed by Netanyahu to silence calls for accountability. Meanwhile, Netanyahu appeared in court in Tel Aviv on Tuesday. He's facing charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Protesters gathered outside the courthouse.
We're here this morning, the same as every week since the beginning of the trials of Benjamin Netanyahu, protesting to make sure that these trials go as planned, that Mr. Netanyahu does not receive a pardon, does not escape responsibility for the crimes that he's being judged and the crimes that he's going to be judged for, which are the more serious ones. But he's going to pay.
In Britain, Swedish activist Greta Thunberg was arrested in London Tuesday for taking part in peaceful protests expressing solidarity with a group of Palestine Action political prisoners on hunger strike. Greta Thunberg sat outside the building of an insurance company holding a sign that said, "I support the Palestine Action prisoners. I oppose genocide," unquote. Activists said the insurance company, Aspen, provides services to Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of an Israeli weapons manufacturer. Earlier this year, the British government banned Palestine Action under its Terrorism Act. The Palestine Action prisoners started a hunger strike as they await trial, demanding, among other requests, to be released on bond. At least two of the hunger strikers have refused food for over 50 days, with doctors warning they're at risk of death. Days after the December 19th deadline for the release of all files related to the late serial sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, and under enormous pressure, the Justice Department released more than 11,000 files Tuesday, totaling nearly 30,000 pages of documents. This includes emails sent between FBI personnel back in 2019 mentioning 10 possible co-conspirators of Epstein. One is described as a, quote, wealthy businessman in Ohio. The emails also detail that, quote, three have been located in Florida and serve grand jury subpoenas, one in Boston, one in New York City, and one in Connecticut were located and served, unquote. Ghislaine Maxwell is the only Epstein accomplice to be charged criminally and is currently serving a 20-year sentence on federal sex trafficking charges. The Justice Department is desperately looking to hire outside attorneys to work on redactions in the Epstein files it continues to hold. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Supreme Court Tuesday blocked the Trump administration's deployment of hundreds of National Guard to the Chicago area. The High Court sided with U.S. District Judge April Perry, who first blocked the deployment of troops to Illinois back in October. In a 6-3 decision, the majority wrote, quote, at this preliminary stage, the government has failed to identify a source of authority that would allow the military to execute the laws in Illinois, unquote. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker hailed the ruling as, quote, a big win for Illinois and American democracy, unquote. Just minutes after the Supreme Court blocked President Trump's deployment of federal troops to Chicago, Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry announced 350 National Guard troops will arrive in New Orleans before New Year's Eve and will stay through February. The troops are expected to join Border Patrol agents who've been cracking down on immigrants in New Orleans. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is suing Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, challenging state laws that restrict immigration arrests at courthouses, hospitals, daycare centers, and public universities. ICE's so-called Operation Midway Blitz has led to the arrest of more than 4,000 people in the Chicago area. Data shows only 15% had criminal offenses, which are mostly comprised of minor traffic offenses, misdemeanors, or nonviolent felonies. Jillian Kaler, a spokesperson for Governor Pritzker, said, quote, the Trump administration's masked agents are not targeting the worst of the worst. They're harassing and detaining law-abiding U.S. citizens and black and brown people, unquote. A federal judge ruled Tuesday the Trump administration must restore federal disaster aid to 12 states that refused to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. The Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, had reduced more than $233 million from Connecticut, Delaware, the District of Columbia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. In a statement, the Massachusetts Attorney General, Andrea Joy Campbell, said, quote, this victory ensures the Trump administration cannot punish states that refuse to help carry out its cruel immigration agenda, particularly by denying them life-saving funding that helps prepare for and respond to disasters and emergencies, she said. The Trump administration's banned abortion care for veterans nationwide. The Department of Veterans Affairs Monday issued an internal memo confirming it'll no longer provide abortion assistance, even in cases of rape, incest, or threats to life and health. The policy shift includes U.S. states where abortion is still legal. The move eliminates abortion protections issued for veterans by the Biden administration in 2022 after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The Center for Reproductive Rights said the rule change was ushered through by the White House Budget Director Russell Vogt and VA Secretary Doug Collins, who are openly anti-abortion. Nancy Northup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, said in a statement, quote, everyone should be appalled by this heartless policy. President Trump said he would leave abortion to the states, but he continues to seize new opportunities to restrict it nationally, unquote. The Trump administration will resume garnishing the wages of people who are on default on their student loans starting in January. Billionaire Linda McMahon, head of the Education Department, told the Washington Post her agency has already notified some 1,000 student loan borrowers that their pay will be seized. Approximately 5 million people are in default. This comes after the Trump administration began withholding tax refunds and Social Security benefits from some student loan borrowers in default, as it also slashed affordable repayment options for millions of people. Persis Yu, deputy executive director of Protect Borrowers, said in a statement, quote, at a time when families across the country are struggling with stagnant wages and an affordability crisis, this administration's decision to garnish wages from defaulted student loan borrowers is cruel, unnecessary, and irresponsible, she said. Sudan's prime minister presented a plan to the United Nations Security Council Monday seeking to end Sudan's devastating war, which has led to the world's worst humanitarian crisis since it erupted in April 2023. The plan would see the UN, Arab League, and African Union monitor a ceasefire and the withdrawal of rapid support forces, paramilitaries, from territories under their control. RSF fighters would be placed in camps and disarmed. Those not implicated in war crimes would be reintegrated into society. It's highly unlikely the RSF will agree to such terms. Meanwhile, a senior UN official warned the continued flow of high-tech weaponry into Sudan is worsening an already dire humanitarian crisis. This is UN Assistant Secretary General Mohamed Khalid Khayari.
Mr. President, the continuous supply of weapons, increasingly sophisticated and deadly, remains a key driver of the conflict. Sudan is saturated with arms. Calls to end these flows have gone unheeded, and there has been no accountability.
Human rights groups have called on the Trump administration to end arms transfers to the United Arab Emirates until it stops arming RSF paramilitaries who've committed genocide, according to an assessment by the State Department. Meanwhile, fighting continues in Sudan. On Monday, the Sudanese army announced it had recaptured a town in North Kordofan State. Elsewhere, Doctors Without Borders is warning of a rapidly spreading measles outbreak in Sudan's Darfur region, where hundreds of thousands have been displaced by an RSF offensive. In Colorado, longtime immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueta Ramirez has been released from ICE jail after nearly 10 months of detention. She reunited with her family on Tuesday following her release on bond. Vizgueta was arrested in March, ambushed by ICE agents during her work break at Target, and later transferred to an immigration jail in Aurora run by the private prison company Geo Group. Jeanette Vizgueta gained national attention in 2017 when she took sanctuary at a Denver church along with her four children, three of whom are U.S.-born to avoid deportation. I spoke to Jeanette Vizgueta yesterday. We'll have more on her release later in the broadcast. And Betty Reed Soskin, the U.S.'s oldest park ranger, died at the age of 104, 104 years old. She first became a park ranger at 85 and worked at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond, California. During World War II, Soskin worked as a file clerk in a segregated union hall in the San Francisco Bay Area. In the 60s, Soskin held fundraisers to support the Black Panthers. In a 2015 interview with the Interior Department, Soskin said, quote, "When I'm on the streets or on an escalator or elevator, I'm making every little girl of color aware of a career choice she may not have known she had," unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Days after the December 19th deadline for the release of all files related to the late serial sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, and under enormous pressure, the Justice Department has just released more than 11,000 files Tuesday, totaling nearly 30,000 pages of documents. This includes internal FBI emails from 2019 that mentioned 10 possible co-conspirators of Epstein, including one who's described as a, quote, wealthy businessman in Ohio, unquote. The emails also note that, quote, three have been located in Florida and serve grand jury subpoenas, one in Boston, one in New York City, one in Connecticut were located and served, unquote. Ghislaine Maxwell is the only Epstein accomplice to be charged criminally. She's currently serving a 20-year sentence on federal sex trafficking charges. This comes after the DOJ Monday briefly published thousands of additional documents related to Epstein. The second tranche of documents were available online for several hours, but then disappeared from the Justice Department's website without explanation. The documents contain wide-ranging references to Donald Trump. One email written by an assistant U.S. attorney during Trump's first term in early 2020 found Trump was a passenger aboard Epstein's private jet on at least eight flights between 1993 and 1996. On at least four of those flights, Epstein's co-conspirator Ghislaine Maxwell was also present. Trump has not been directly accused of criminal conduct and claims to have cut ties with Epstein decades ago. In a joint statement, multiple survivors slammed the government's recent document dump for failing to redact numerous victim identities while also making, quote, abnormal and extreme redactions with no explanation, like page upon page completely blacked out. This is Epstein survivor Charlene Rochard speaking on NBC.
I'm very upset with the justice system because there's full pages that are totally blacked out. Mm-hmm. And I know, I don't know about you, but my name is not a full page. We only ask that our names be redacted. Mm-hmm. That's all we asked for. So pages and pages and pages of black on black on black is just unacceptable.
On Monday, 18 survivors of Epstein wrote a joint letter condemning the Justice Department's release of just a fraction of the files demanded by law and called on Congress to hold hearings to ensure the Trump administration is fully complying with the Epstein Files Transparency Act. This is Epstein survivor Haley Robson, who voted for Trump in the 2024 presidential election, responding to the new files. She was speaking on CNN.
At the end of the day, I am no longer supporting this administration. I redact any support I've ever given to him, Pam Bondi, Cash Patel. I am so disgusted with this administration. I think that Pam Bondi and Cash Patel both need to resign. And I would love to see number 47 get impeached over this.
This comes as Democratic Congressmember Robert Garcia, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, is asking the DOJ's Inspector General to investigate why the FBI failed to act on a 1996 complaint by survivor Maria Farmer against Jeffrey Epstein that he and his associates were producing child sexual abuse material. Garcia wrote, quote, "For survivors like Maria Farmer, her family, and all the people Jeffrey Epstein abused in the decades that followed this unanswered complaint, this was not merely a missed investigative opportunity. It was a profound betrayal by their own government," unquote. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna and Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie, who sponsored the Epstein Files Transparency Act, say Attorney General Pam Bondi should be held in contempt, could be fined for every day she fails to release the full Epstein files. From all on all of this, we're joined in our New York studio by Vicki Ward, longtime investigative journalist, host and co-producer of the podcast series Chasing Ghislaine, the untold story of the woman in Epstein's shadow, which also became a TV series by the same name. Vicki, welcome back to Democracy Now! First of all, if you can respond to what has happened so far, December 19th was the deadline. That was Friday. Now the Justice Department, days later, after releasing thousands of documents, then erasing them from the website, now calling for for attorneys in the United States to come to the Justice Department and help them redact what has been redacted, what has not been redacted. Can you respond to all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think right from the get-go, right from when months ago, Pam Bondi said in an interview, "Oh, I've got the Epstein files sitting on my desk." I mean, that was the first indication, I think, of the contemptuous, cavalier attitude that has gone on inside this Justice Department.
Right, she said she was going to release the
so-called
client list.
She was files, they were there
list.
On her desk. I don't think that these thousands and thousands of pages were sitting on her desk. I mean, so, you know, and it's heartbreaking, frankly, to see these files being dribbled out. It's so against the spirit in which the victims went to Capitol Hill, asked for transparency, which bipartisan Congress agreed with them that they are owed this transparency so that crimes like this may never happen again. And now to have this mishmash, which even I, who am not a victim of sexual abuse from Jeffrey Epstein, but I sat through Ghislaine Maxwell's trial and I found it very, very upsetting. I think most of us journalists, you know, we're hard bitten, you know, we've seen some things. It was really difficult to hear the stories of abuse in that courtroom and really difficult to learn the scale of it. And these pages have that story writ large again and again and again. And given the chaos of this rollout, there's no easy way for these survivors to quickly search what they're looking for. I want to see...
That was part of the law, by the way, that right. there had to be a working search function on these documents.
And there isn't. And they have to wade through page after page after page of very, very difficult stuff. I think on, just on a moral basis, it's disgusting.
It's really important to be talking to you today because years ago, you wrote this piece in Vanity Fair. You're the person who spoke to Maria Farmer. Now, that conversation did not appear in Vanity Fair. And if you can remind our viewers and listeners what happened, because this has to do with the collusion of the press with Jeffrey Epstein. But you know her story very well.
Yes.
This woman who for decades has tried to stop the abuse by Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yes. Well, I didn't speak to Maria Farmer just once. You know, in the fall of 2002, when I was assigned to write this profile of Jeffrey Epstein, I met with Maria. I spoke to her many, many times. And she said exactly what has now appeared in the FBI's files. She said that in 1996, she had had a horrific night while up in a guest house of Jeffrey Epstein's home on Les Wexner's estate in Ohio. She'd been up there painting. She was an artist. Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell had come to visit her. There had followed some horrible sexual abuse, after which she had run out of the house, taken her dog, run.
The sexual abuse perpetrated by both Ghislaine and Jeffrey Epstein.
Both. But in all of this, she had left behind a lockbox of nude photographs of her sisters. Not just Annie, there was another sister. And, you know, she was a figurative artist. She you know, that's the kind of work that she did. And she was terrified that Epstein was going to do, excuse me, you know, something terrible with these. And she got phone calls from both Epstein and Maxwell saying, threatening her. So she phoned, in fact, she told me she phoned the police in New York first. And they said, this is not for us. This is, you know, going across state lines. You have to phone the FBI. She did phone the FBI. Now, the FBI back in the day, I phoned the FBI.
They threatened to burn her.
but she phoned the FBI about the lockbox. And was worried, desperately worried, you know, what could they do with nude photographs of her sisters, who were babies, teenagers.
They were her younger sisters.
And you know, when I was reporting this piece, you know, the FBI tend not to answer journalists like me, so I wasn't able to get that record back then. I also phoned the police, and they didn't produce their records, which I wish they had, because they had a record too. And, but, you know, as I think you know, and a lot of journalists know how this tragic story ends, which was that when, towards the closing of the piece, I had to go to Jeffrey Epstein and to Ghislaine Maxwell with the allegations of both Maria Farmer as to what had happened and her younger sister, Annie, who had said very clearly on the record that she had been taken to New Mexico for a weekend and
to his estate there.
Yes, and you know, at the age of 16, and had to have a topless massage from Ghislaine Maxwell, and then Jeffrey Epstein one morning jumped into bed for quote unquote a cuddle with her. Epstein went berserk when I put those allegations, as did Ghislaine Maxwell. Absolutely berserk. He, you know, suddenly sent over a whole bunch of paperwork that he claimed were letters from their mother, letters from them that showed that, no, you know, this could not be true. And, you know, the next thing I knew was that as we were closing the piece, a fact checker sent me a note saying, you're not going to believe who's now in the office at Vanity Fair. It was Jeffrey Epstein, who, you know, who knows what happened.
Meeting with
Graydon Carter, the editor of the magazine. I do not know what was said in that meeting. I will say, Amy, that
you were about to give birth to twins.
I was at home on bed rest. I thought we were done with this piece. I did find in these files that when the first batch that was released, that there was a section in a binder containing photographs that was called Vanity Fair. I did notice that the photographs in that binder in that section were the ones that were used accompanying my piece in the magazine, which is very unusual because Vanity Fair normally prides itself on its photography as much as it does on its words. So one has to assume they provided the photographs. One has to ask, what was the quid pro quo? My piece finally ran. The Farmer Sisters and their allegations were not in it. And the reason that is so terrible and devastating is that we had exposed them, I had exposed them, to Ghislaine Maxwell and to Graydon Carter. And the story doesn't end there. The FBI then phoned me about, I want to say a year later, 2004, about the Farmer Sisters. And I did tell them what had happened. So I would like to see my interview notes somewhere in these
files. And you haven't
files.
Seen them yet.
No, I have not.
But that certainly is not classified information. That
no.
is proof, once again,
right.
of all of the information that has not been released.
100%. 100%. The other thing I think you see, it's not just the rollout itself that shambles. The content in it kind of paints a picture of a shambolic FBI. You know, this is an FBI that seems to take its lead quite often from the press. I will say it's interesting, you know, I learned that something I'd reported is kind of laid out on the page clearly, which is that were it not for David Boies, the lawyer who represented Virginia Giuffre in her civil litigation against Ghislaine Maxwell. Virginia sued for defamation.
Who brought down
yes.
Andrew, the prince,
yes.
no longer.
Right. And Virginia, as we know, tragically died of suicide earlier this year. But you can see in these files, in that litigation, which was in 2016, you can see notes of conversations. David Boies went to the feds. He went to the Southern District, said, you need to look at what is in this discovery, need to look at these depositions, because this shows the bigger crime. You see the feds tracking this, but you don't see them doing anything until, again, you see them pass around links to the Miami Herald, links to Julie Brown's story in end of 2018. And it's almost like they are having to follow, you know, almost, you know, like Inspector Clouseau, these breadcrumbs that are left for them by everybody else. And I'm sure the survivors find this really disheartening in a way to watch.
Why do you think President Trump has approached this the way he has? And what about the information and all that has come out around him, not necessarily
yeah.
criminal, but the removal of his name from so many different documents? And then you see his name once in a document that was redacted, and so you know that it's actually him. He's the one who campaigned on the release
okay.
of the Jeffrey Epstein documents. Now he had to sign this release into law, but the way they are dragging their feet, talk as we wrap up about what you expect to see, the incredible power of the survivors banding together.
Well, you know, this is speculation, but my gut, and I do know President Trump, it tells me that he doesn't like a story in which there's any sort of gray or nuance that he isn't somehow the best, the absolute best. And you know, and this is a story which again and again and again brings up his past, and a past that presented a very different portrait of Donald Trump than the one he would like to portray now. I will say that, you know, having sat in the Maxwell trial, we did see his name come up on the screen, on the flight logs, in that key period when Maxwell and Epstein were grooming and recruiting one of their major victims up who was attending Interlochen, a school for artistic gifted children. You did see Flight's name again and Trump's name again and again on the manifest. And it was a head scratcher, because it was really impossible at that time to put the pieces of this jigsaw puzzle together.
No, because he denied being on any flights, and he denied being at the island.
Well, and I never saw any records of him being on the island. I don't know if he denied being on any flights, but I think that, you can see if you're Trump, this is all too close for comfort. And it's not very comfortable to have these things out. And Trump being Trump, he'd rather not address it.
And where do you see this going for the survivors and for Pam Bondi? Could she be held in contempt?
Well, I really hope Congress does their job. I mean, you know, one of the things we need to see in the Trump administration is the different branches of government actually doing what they're supposed to do and holding each other to account.
Finally, you are the expert on Ghislaine Maxwell. She is now in a minimum security prison. No sex abuse, no sex perpetrator has been put in a prison camp like she has after she had interviews with what the deputy attorney general, who was Trump's former attorney. Could you see Trump pardoning her? And she has appealed for the reopening of the case.
Well, I think two of the people who come out absolutely appallingly from this latest document dump is Ghislaine Maxwell in her correspondence with the former Prince Andrew, arranging quote unquote inappropriate girls for him. I think people will be sickened by that. As regarding a pardon, never say never, but I think President Trump is a man who's concerned at this point with legacy and with history. And I think if he were to pardon Ghislaine Maxwell, that blot would stain all the other things, accomplishments he likes to talk about that he's done. So I personally would be shocked.
I want to thank you, Vicki Ward. We'll continue to follow the story. Longtime investigative journalist, host and co-producer of the podcast series Chasing Ghislaine, the untold story of the woman in the Epstein shadow, which also became a TV series by the same name. When we come back, we speak to longtime immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueta Ramirez. She was just released Monday from a Colorado ICE jail after more than 9 months. A judge ruled her detention was unconstitutional. Back in 30 seconds.
Se quedan mudos, otros tienen memoria para olvidar. Si la violencia es un espejo que se rompe y nuestras lágrimas caídas gritarán, solo recuerda que mi cara tiene un nombre y nunca más se callará.
Again by La Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Colorado, where longtime immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueta Ramirez has been released from an ICE jail after almost 10 months in detention. Jeanette reunited with her family Monday after she was released on bond following a judge's ruling her detention was unconstitutional. She was arrested in March, ambushed by ICE agents during her work break at Target, later transferred to an immigration jail in Aurora, Colorado, run by the private prison company Geo Group. Jeanette Vizgueta gained national attention in 2017 when she took sanctuary in a Denver church along with her children, three of whom are U.S. born, to avoid deportation. In May, Jeanette won the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award. I spoke with Jeanette Vizgueta on Tuesday. You have been in jail for 9 months. How does it feel to be free?
This moment is one mixed emotions.
And my person and my family, 917 days, that's long time in detention. But every time have hope that one day I'm released. My legal team work very strong. I'm continuing my job, same in detention. My community fight very strong for me, same for 9 months. And finally, I'm here. I'm very emotional in this moment. As the yesterday, my kids and me, as they mentioned, the a similar one block, the emotions, as the is real. I'm here all the time. It's possible. Talk to my kids, touch my kids, kiss my kids, my kiddos. It's very emotional. It's very, very emotional in this moment.
Can you talk about what your plans are now and your response to the judge's ruling, Judge Nina Wong?
Well, at first I'm happy for the decision, for take this bond. My plan later, my case continue. My case not finished, my case continue. I don't know for how many time. My plan is these last days that is year, I pass my time for my family later in the new year, come back and my job, the activist. I never stop.
That was Jeanette Vizgueta Ramirez speaking with us on Tuesday after she was released Monday after more than 9 months in an ICE jail in Aurora, Colorado. We'll hear from her, more from her, in a minute. But first, we go to Denver, and we're joined by Jennifer Piper, Program Director at the American Friends Service Committee, part of a coalition supporting Jeanette. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jennifer. It's great to have you with us. You all held a rally news conference yesterday. That's why Jeanette had to finish her conversation early with us so she could get to it. Talk about the significance of the judge's ruling. She demanded she be released, not be wearing a ankle shackle. She said that her detention was unconstitutional.
Yes, the district judge, after 9 months and many arguments back and forth, did rule that on Jeanette's habeas, that her prolonged detention was unconstitutional, and ordered that the government hold a bond hearing within a week, and that the burden of proof in that hearing would be on the government. Usually in immigration court, you have to prove yourself that you're not a flight risk or a danger and you're good moral character. In this instance, that was flipped. And at that court hearing, the government continued to try to impede her right to speech and the public access by denying journalists and observers access to that public hearing for 2.5 hours. We finally gained access, but it took us 2.5 hours of arguing with GEO and ICE officials to get into that hearing.
And talk about what Jeanette has meant and symbolized. I mean, there was a private Senate bill that was passed in her case that prolonged her ability to be free in this country and seek legalization. It was introduced right by Senator Michael Bennet.
Yeah, Jeanette's been an activist and a human rights advocate for almost 30 years. And even before she founded the Sanctuary Coalition here in Denver and utilized that coalition, she's been a labor rights and immigrant activist. So her detention was intentional to try and silence people across the country, not only immigrant leaders, but also citizens. I can't tell you how many people I heard from that said, you know, if she can't win her case with all of her activism and notoriety over all of these years, what is the chance for the rest of us? And the fact that she is free now after 9 months of weekly vigils, incredible work by Lictor Immigration, the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network, and the Sturm College of Laws Immigration and Policy Clinic. The fact that she is free right now is emboldening people across this country to continue to take up space and to not cede to this administration's efforts to silence people. Really, at the end of the day, these corporations, Geo Group, BI, the 10 other contractors that have been paid millions of dollars by this administration to try and hunt down our neighbors, their goal is social control. And they've thrown immense power that they have at their disposal at all of us. But this also demonstrates the fragility of their hold over everyday people when we stand up together. Our safety comes from our connection, trust, and continuing to claim space in the public sphere. It comes from doing new things, things that each of us have never done before, and being connected across all of these struggles. Whether you're a fisherman in Venezuela or Palestine, whether you're a person who's about to lose their affordable care, every single one of us in this moment is under attack, and these billionaires, their goal is control.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, Jennifer Piper, Program Director at the American Friends Service Committee, Colorado, because we want to end this segment again with the words of Jeanette Vizgeta, who is named one of the 100 most influential people of the year by Time Magazine in 2017. She was released from ICE jail on Monday, spent that day with her family. Yesterday on Tuesday, I had a chance to talk with her. She's the mother of four when she was arrested by federal agents in Denver in March. I'd asked her to describe her time in detention.
I have been jail protest for 9 months inside the detention. Some parts is strong, some parts I continue navigate, say continue documentate the conditions and detention, continue take testimonies. I'm trying to maintain my brain occupied for my mental health not broke. 9 months is long time in detention. But I continue fight for the condition, continue fight for help people inside, for support and connect for resource my people in detention. But it's difficult these 9 months. It's difficult for everybody, not only for me. I don't care if it's 1 day, 2 days, one more. Whatever time in detention, no, it's good. Mm.
You have described yourself as a political prisoner. Can you explain why? Why you feel targeted?
The attack very bad my community for have violation my First Amendment. I never quiet injustice, not only for the immigrant system, for whatever injustice. My job is the social justice, human rights, civil rights, and labor rights, and funding immigrant rights here in Colorado. Obviously, I need a spoken media, I need a spoken social media, criticize this government. If this government go back me, it's the same the last time in the administration 45, but in this time coming more aggressive, follow me, he arrested me for my free speech.
Can you describe what it was like inside? Can you tell us about the other people inside, why they were there in the for-profit GEO jail in Aurora, Colorado, where you were held?
Everybody, I need to understand this corporation, GEO Processing Center and CCI Corporation, is private detention, take billions and billions and billions of money for take people in detention. The companies, the telephone, the companies, the tablet calls, the companies, the commissary, take very billions money for these people in detention. All people in detention, all immigrants around the world have rights. Need fight, need continue strong. The coward people only living. But my people, my immigrant people is a strong people. Need continue fight.
Do you, Jeanette, have to still check in with ICE?
Yes, in January I need go and check in. is this continuous end game in my case. I need notification 48 hours before in case I need travel in other states. Is they where? How many days? This is the plan, the game, the continued game. But okay, I'm follow everything whatever I need. I no have excuse the other time arrested me. I continue my job, only continue my job. I continue to try remove these restrictions.
I see that the judge ruled that you do not have to wear an electronic bracelet. Is that right? A shackle on your foot or on your arm?
Yeah, this judge, the lawyer government tried put this restriction, but I don't need it. I know it's the risk to escape. I know I'm not dangerous people for the community. I don't need monitoring my life. I'm activist. I need moving. I need going different states. No need ankle bracer. This is only used for continued damage to mental health. It continue have control in your life. But I don't need it. I don't have ankle bracer. I don't have dispositive app or telephone. Not have these restrictions.
That was Colorado immigrant rights activist Jeanette Vizgueda Ramirez speaking with Democracy Now! On Tuesday from Denver, Colorado. She was freed Monday from ICE detention after 9 months on Monday. A federal judge, Judge Nina Wong, that her detention was unconstitutional. Up next, an update on the growing calls to release Palestinian activist Lakhal Kardia, joined Gaza solidarity protests at Columbia, and has been detained in an ICE jail in Texas for nearly 10 months. Stay with us.
Passion. And I'm this. We got passion.
Montreal musician Paul Carniello. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at the growing calls to release a Palestinian woman from New Jersey who's been held in ICE detention in Texas for nearly 10 months. Lakhal Kardia was arrested last year at a Gaza solidarity protest at Columbia University, but the charges were dismissed. Then when she went to her ICE check-in this past March, she was arrested and immediately sent to the Prairieland Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas, where she's been held ever since. Lawyers from CLEAR and the Texas Civil Rights Project and Boston University School of Law Immigrants' Rights Clinic are helping on her case. NPR's Radio Diaries recently aired part of a phone call between Lakhal Kardia and her cousin, Hamza Abishaban, who talks to her almost every day.
I received a call from my mother telling me there are people asking for you from the government. At the beginning, I thought like they're missing a form or something. Okay, I'm just going to solve this issue and then like I'll have my green card soon. But they took my fingerprints and all that. They said, you're going to Texas. I said, Texas? Like, that's really far away. And when I arrived to Texas, the place was overcrowded.
How many people are there with you?
So right now we're 87. And the capacity of this place is 37. It's a lot of people sleeping on the floor.
Wow.
Yeah. Maybe another word to describe this place, a big bathroom. It's open. Everything is open. There is no privacy.
That's Lakhal Kardia speaking from ICE jail in Texas to her cousin. So the New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey City Council has just passed a resolution calling for the immediate release of Lakhal. And
Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker are also calling for Lakhal Qardia's release. For more, we're joined by Leila Haddad, Palestinian journalist from Gaza, media strategist who's helping to raise awareness about the ongoing detention of Lakhal, and just came back from visiting her in Texas. Leila is the co-editor of Gaza in Silence, author of Gaza Mom, Palestine Politics, Parenting, and Everything in Between. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Leila. Talk about Lakhal, why she has been held for almost 10 months after going to her New Jersey ICE check-in.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy. That's sort of the question that everyone is asking. I think partly because her case sort of fell between the cracks. She wasn't a student or a public-facing activist per se. She didn't have those support networks. And her case shares a lot in common. Of course, it's interwoven with the cases of all the others that we have heard of. Mahmoud Khalil, Mohsen Mahdawi, Dr. Badr Suri Khan, and Rumaysa Ozturk. But it just didn't get the kind of attention that the other cases got early on. Even though, as you summarized earlier, even though two judges have actually called for her release and found that she is not deportable to Israel. Unfortunately, the government has been blocking those decisions through various legal maneuvering, and that's partly why she's still being held under very harsh conditions, as she herself attested to.
Leila, the Trump administration mistakenly called her a Columbia student and tried to say she'd actively participated in anti-American pro-terrorist activities and a pro-Hamas demonstration, what they often called the Gaza demonstrations on campuses across the country. Your response?
Lakhal Qardia has been held and has argued in court that that her detention is unconstitutional, that it violates the First and the Fifth Amendments, and it's simply part of a broader trend that we have seen post-Trump to crack down on any dissent and use immigration law to weaponize immigration law to silence dissent and to criminalize free speech, especially when that speech relates to Palestine, to defending Palestinian life, to criticizing Israel, and to challenging U.S. policy, just as we have seen in all of these other cases. She was motivated to act and to protest, exercising her First Amendment rights, which are available to her, even as a non-citizen. Just like so many other people, she was spurred to action by her humanity, in as much as she was spurred to action by her own personal loss. Lakhal was born in Jerusalem, raised in the occupied West Bank under Israeli military occupation. Her mother is from Gaza. She was separated from her for 20 years because of the Israeli blockade and was keeping in constant touch with her. She came to the United States legally, and her petition for residency was approved to reunite with her mother. She was caring for her mother and her younger brother, who has special needs. And she, very crucially, 200 of her family members, 13 since the so-called ceasefire took place, have been killed by Israel with the support and the complicity of the United States. And for all these reasons, and for the reasons that millions of us took to the streets, she was protesting not only at the gates of Columbia, but at many other protests as well.
I mean, she was arrested last March. It was just days after Mahmoud Khalil was arrested, the Columbia student, and right before Mohsen was arrested. They have both been released. Mohsen's back at Columbia University. But she remains in jail. Can you talk about what she looks like now? I understand she's lost about a third of her body weight.
Yes, she looked very pale. She has lost a significant amount of weight. That is correct. And she has been detained, as you mentioned, in this ICE jail for almost 10 months, despite this judge calling for her release, despite finding that her prolonged detention is likely unconstitutional. And despite all this, she marked also her 33rd birthday, a very solemn 33rd birthday, in which she spoke about how the other women with her in that facility tried to cheer her up, and they formed a kind of sisterhood and bond. And she, I will say, she advocates on their behalf. Despite all this, in her words, she says the conditions here are designed to break the human spirit, but that despite all this, she derives hope and inspiration from all of the people that continue to advocate on her behalf, and that it has only increased her resolve to continue to be an advocate and an activist, not only for all of these women, but more broadly for Palestinian liberation when she gets out, inshallah. Mm.
We just have a minute to go. Leila Haddad, if you can talk about what you're calling for, what Amnesty International is calling for, what senators are calling for, including her own senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker.
For her immediate release, there's absolutely no reason for her to continue to be detained, even though her cousin that you mentioned earlier, Hamza, her family, had agreed and had actually paid a very high $20,000 bond that was then returned. The government immediately blocked her release. She's not a flight risk. She's not a danger to her society. She has strong community ties. She has no criminal history. And so we're calling for her immediate release while her case continues to make its way through the courts. And this is the same thing that Senators Van Hollen and Kim and other congressmen from her district as well have been calling for. She should not be in that ICE jail for one day longer. Leila. And she faces an imminent risk if she was deported.
Leila Haddad, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestinian journalist from Gaza, hoping to raise awareness about the ongoing detention of Laqa Qardia, Palestinian woman from New Jersey, arrested at Columbia University protest. Charges were dropped, but has been held for nearly 10 months in a Texas ICE jail. Many are calling for her release. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. An early happy birthday to Raquel Rodriguez Phipps and to Yusra Razuki. I'm Amy Goodman.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University,